Well, good morning. Are we doing here with the mic? We're good? All right. Well, I have to say off the start, any church family that can sit and hear 10 missionaries in one setting deserves some kind of an award. You're amazing. In fact, I would suggest you've been sitting for a long time. Why don't you just stand up and stretch and, you know, punch someone beside you or just get the blood flowing a bit. We have time for that, so... All right. I'd love to let you do a whole aerobic session, but we won't have time for that. But I want to say as well, this church has been incredible, and we thank you so much for the way you stood behind Lynn and I for many years. We've been with Sen since we were first married here in this church back in 1984. And 85, and we just returned from Thailand on Thursday. It was 31 degrees in Thailand on Thursday. This morning when I got up, I said, Lord, help me just get to the church.
It's still
30. It's 31 in the wrong direction. So Lynn is not with me. She's in Abbotsford recovering from... sinus infection and all, and I just thank God for her. She'd love to be here. She's praying for us today, but has not made the trip with me. Well, lots we could say, but I want to transition into the message that I feel God has laid on my heart for us today, which I've entitled Weakness and the Gospel. And I'd like to begin with a question for you, and that is, what is the great challenge that Jesus has given to us, the church, to complete in these last days? Well, one day Jesus was sitting with his disciples on the Mount of Olives when they asked him, "Tell us," they said, "what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?" And Jesus responded by giving them really a litany of different things that would begin to converge, that would be signs of his return. And then he gave them the final sign indicating the end of the age. And he said this, "And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come." Now, most of our English translations use the word nation, but the original Greek word is ethnosen, meaning all ethnic peoples, and not nations as we tend to think of geographically bound countries, the 200 and some that are in the world today. In other words, Jesus is saying there will be a gospel witness within the cultures of all ethnic peoples. The good news will be accessible among all ethno-linguistic peoples, and then the end will come. And so the task that was given to us, the great challenge for the church, among many other things, is very clear. And so we cannot sit back today, waiting expectantly for the Lord's second coming when whole cultures have not yet heard of his first. The church must press on until there is no place left where Christ is not known, no people group left that does not have the good news accessible within the context of their own culture. So who will go? Who will take the good news from cultures that already have the testimony of Christ into those who do not? Who will go across the street, across the city, across our great nation, or to faraway places around the world where the gospel of Christ is not known? Well, our tendency is to think that, well, it must be someone else because it certainly wouldn't be me. Right? We're quick to give all the reasons why it couldn't possibly be me. A task like this certainly requires, well, superheroes. And I'm not a superhero, so I couldn't go. When we think about what it must be like to go into other cultures, we think they must be people with qualities like great linguistic skills and persuasive speakers, have great courage, be tireless, be able to make friendships anywhere they go, have a stomach of iron and a heart of gold. They must be like the Marvel stories, you know, the movies, or something like the Apostle Paul, because certainly he must have been a superhero. I mean, he's the one that went across the Roman world to share the gospel of Jesus Christ. He was a superhero, wasn't he? Well, let's take a look. The key passage that I want us to look at today is in 2 Corinthians chapter 12 and verse 7 to 10. And we'll take a moment to read it. I'm reading from the NIV. To keep me from becoming conceited because of these surpassingly great revelations, there was given me a thorn in the flesh, a messenger of Satan, to torment me. Three times I pleaded with the Lord to take it away from me, but he said to me, "My grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses, so that Christ's power may rest on me. That is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weaknesses, in insults, in hardships, in persecutions, in difficulties. For when I am weak, then I am strong." Well, I want you to note, first of all, that he says here, there was given a thorn to me, to torment me. Well, different theologians have guessed what that thorn might have been, and we don't know for certain what it was. But the imagery is pretty clear. It was something pretty sharp and pointed that was not comfortable. A few months ago, I was out cutting down the rose bushes around the front of our house and working really quick and aggressively, coming around the one rose bush, and suddenly one of the branches and the thorns pierced through my T-shirt. This was not this month. This was in summer. And it just grabbed hold, and I tried to get loose from it, and it wouldn't let me go, and it was painful. The idea here is that it's painful, it's a constant irritant, it torments. And I would imagine that if each one of you could speak right now and tell me your story, you could tell me about the thorns that have been given to you. And so Paul's reaction is likely just like our reaction, in that he pleaded, "Lord, take it away, please. Take it away." And how does God respond? Well, to put it quite bluntly, the answer was no. And it is not the answer he wanted to hear. It's not the answer you and I want to hear. How many times have you pleaded with the Lord to take away the thorns in your life? Sometimes he does. Sometimes he brings healing to our lives, whether it be emotional pain or physical pain or social pain. But many times the answer is no. The thorns are not removed. And day after day we feel the piercing pain in our emotions, in our hearts, in our bodies. Well, I'd like us to look a little deeper into the context of this passage. Because as we do, we find out that the thorns piercing the side of Paul were given to him while he is proclaiming the gospel among the cities in the Roman Empire that had never heard. That's when this is happening. In fact, if we had time to read the whole preceding chapter, we'd soon find out that the thorn given to Paul was sort of like the last straw to break the camel's back. Paul had already gone through one setback after another, one attack after another, suffering upon suffering, and just when he thinks he can't take it anymore, God allows Satan to pierce him with a thorn. Let me read just a few verses so you understand what was going on. This is from chapter 11, beginning in verse 23. You can just listen if you like. "I have worked much harder. I have been in prison more frequently. I have been flogged more severely, been exposed to death again and again. 5 times I received from the Jews the 40 lashes minus one. 3 times I was beaten with rods. 1 I was stoned. 3 I was shipwrecked. I spent a night and a day in the open sea. I have been constantly on the move. I have been in danger from rivers, in danger from bandits, in danger from my own countrymen, in danger from Gentile tribes, in danger in the city, in danger in the country, in danger at sea, and in danger from false brothers. I have labored and toiled and have often gone without sleep. I have known hunger and thirst and have often gone without food. I have been cold and naked." And then a thorn was given to me. This is not the story of a superhero. This is the story of wave after wave of suffering that Paul experiences in his efforts to bring the gospel where it had not been told. And this is the reoccurring story of the suffering that God's people have faced throughout the centuries, up until today, around the world, as they bring the gospel to those who have not heard. Just when it doesn't seem like it could get any worse, there was given to me a thorn. So the million-dollar question to me comes, why? Goodness, Lord. This guy is giving it all for your kingdom. Why all of this suffering? Why the thorns? Why don't you take it away? Why would you allow such suffering for your servants who take the gospel to the unreached cultures of the world? Why? Well, we don't always get answers to the whys, but in this case, we do. And it's in verse 9, and it's really the core or the central piece of my message today. Whoops. I'll get back here. Slow down. "But he said to me, 'My grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness.'" Power? What power is he talking about? Well, it must not be the power to relieve him of the thorns. It's not the power to live a comfortable life. He's not talking about a power that allows us to do whatever we want with our lives. That's the message that the world feeds us every day. But that's not the power that he's talking about. The power he talks about here is divine power that rests on us so we can be witnesses in a lost world. The power is God's power seen in us that points to something far greater than us. It's all over this letter, and it's all over Paul's writings. Paul says in Romans 1:16, I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for the salvation of those who believe. So back to the key verse. When do we see the power of God working through us? The answer is in our weakness. Wait a minute. It can't really say that. Someone must have messed with the translation. It surely can't say that, but it does. And look at it carefully, because not only is the power of God seen in our weakness, it is made perfect by our weakness. Well, what does that mean? The power of God is seen most clearly in my weakness. It is precisely here in our brokenness, in our pain, in our crisis, and in our failing bodies, it is precisely here that the gospel can best shine through. If that isn't a paradox, I don't know what is. And so the Apostle Paul, in this passage, does a complete flip. Do you notice it? He starts out pleading with God, take it away! But then he does 180 about face after God gives him the explanation, and instead he boasts in his weakness. Think about that. The emotive words are all over the passage. He says, I will boast the more gladly about my weakness so that Christ's power may rest in me. That is why, for Christ's sakes, I delight in weakness. Has he gone out of his mind? Why? Because it is there in the weakness of who I am that the power of who Jesus is best shines through. And it takes the world by surprise. So it's okay, Lord. Don't take away the thorns. Let them be. In fact, you know what? I'm not going to hide my thorns. You see, that's not like us, is it? We want to hide them. We want to put on the best front. I sat in the back because I had to use the washroom 3 times because of old man's problems. Okay? We want to hide that. We want to hide the thorns. Paul says, no, I'm going to boast in my weakness because that's where you're going to see that it's Christ shining through me. And Paul put it another way in the same letter in chapter 4, verse 7, and he said, but we have this treasure in jars of clay to show that this surpassing power is from God and not from us. So consider for a moment what it's like, what it would be like for someone who's never heard of Christ, whether they're in Red Deer or on the other side of the world, and as they get to know you, up close and personal, really get to know you, you who love Jesus and are passionate for him, and they begin to see your flaws. And they begin to see your chronic pain, or that you're a woman who has suffered terrible abuse. And then they begin to see something else. This guy with chronic pain, or this woman who's suffered such abuse, where is the source of their power? It's surely not in them. Why do they love the way they do? Why do they speak the way they do? Why are they here in my life? And then they begin to find out that in this fragile jar of clay, there is something, there is a treasure of immense value. And in time, they want it too. Well, with this text as a foundation that will keep moving through everything I say here this morning, I want to share with you a bit of our story. The unreached peoples of the world today are in hard-to-reach places. That's why the gospel hasn't got there yet. They are not invocation destinies, so they will not match your tourism bucket list. Sad to say. They are unreached precisely because they are in places of poverty and of danger and of persecution. The unreached peoples of the world lie predominantly in the Muslim, Hindu, and Buddhist regions of the world today. They live in cultures that have either never had a Christian witness or have resisted a Christian witness for centuries. Is it any wonder then that if you and I choose to live among the unreached, again, wherever it is, in pockets all across this nation and around the world, our weaknesses are bound to surface quickly. Hardships, persecution, and suffering are certain to come our way, and we can expect that Satan and the demon world will torment us with all manner of thorns. So today I want to talk to you about the Shan people group. They are called by many different names, but to keep it simple, I'll just call them the Shan. The homeland of the Shan, for the last few centuries, has been Myanmar, formerly referred to as Burma, or known as Burma. There are over 5 million Shan who live in the eastern portion of Myanmar. We refer to this region as the Shan States. Why? It's because for centuries, Shan princes have ruled these states. It was like little fiefdoms where each prince and princesses ruled the local town, if you will. The Shan are lowland rice farmers. They are folk Buddhists, meaning each town has a Buddhist temple, and that's the center of community life. But they are also animists, who seek to appease the spirits who live in the lands and the homes and the jungles. The once peaceful Shan states... No, I'm jumping ahead, sorry. The Shan culture, as someone mentioned earlier, is a part of God's diversified beauty in the world. Rich in dance and music and festivals and color and beauty. Yet for centuries, the Shan have been sealed off from any meaningful Christian witness. And then came World War II, which brought horrific war and suffering across Myanmar. Following the war, a sequence of heartbreaking events brought great tragedy to the Shan. The once peaceful Shan states were invaded by military forces hostile to the Shan. Beginning in 1962 with a military junta, until the present, Shan villages have been burned, women have been raped, and these people have been forced to flee from their homes across the Shan states. And so the Shan, by and large, lost their homeland and fled. Some have found pockets of land within the Shan states where they are relatively free from harm. Others, more fortunate, were able to cross south into Thailand. And today, this is the dream of many of the Shan, to flee to Thailand. As migrants in North Thailand, at least they are free from their enemies. It is here that our story intersects with the Shan. Send International had its beginnings among the Shan by sending one Filipino couple, Jenny and Darwin, to live in a Shan village of migrants in northern Thailand. Since 2011, Jenny and Darwin have loved the people here in what we will call today the Valley Village. 3 years later, Lynn and I began to visit several times a year to Jenny and Darwin in this village. More recently, we moved to Chiang Rai, which is just 45 minutes away, and we give leadership to them as a couple, and the four of us are the Shan team in this village. In the Valley Village, our team has helped these migrants in any way we can. Through sustainable livelihood projects, we've gained trust. Many of the Shan welcomed us into their homes. where we've done oral storytelling, since the parents and the grandparents do not read or write, and they love hearing the stories of the Bible from creation to Christ. Well, over these years, the children who are learning Thai, because they're Shan speakers, they're learning Thai in the local elementary school, were given their very first book by Jenny and Darwin. As you see here, a Thai Bible. And they could read it. And as we taught the children the scriptures, some of them came to know and love the Lord Jesus Christ. But then came the crisis. When the girls finish elementary school, in this culture, in this context, the parents have no money to send their teenage girls to high school, nor do they see any need for it. Instead, the parents often will send them away as prostitutes and instantly receive a large cash payout. It is like winning the lottery for the poor. So these girls who had come to know Jesus were being threatened to sell their bodies to enrich their parents as they are taught in their culture. It was at that time that the Lord gave us the idea of a scholarship program. We asked each set of parents to let us find a sponsor for their daughter. The sponsor would provide for all the costs of their education, including nutritious meals at school, if only they would not send their daughters away. Because of the trust that we'd built in the village, all the parents agreed. We started with 12 scholars 4 years ago. This is Lynn with some of them in our home. Today we have 17. Yet through these years of ministry in the Valley Village, we long to see men come to know Christ. We're thrilled with the transformation of these teen girls, of the rescue that has been accomplished. But where are the men? And so we began to pray for men. It was at this time that the Lord began to answer our prayers in a most unusual way. The answer came through our dorm mom. And thank you for your gifts to our dorm today. Well, this dorm mom is a Shan girl in her mid-20s who came to know Christ when she was 14. On the day of her baptism, her father began to beat her. Every time she would go to church, when her Christian friends would come to pick her up, he would take a broom or a stick and beat her before she left for church. And yet she never gave up the faith. And now she's a dorm mom serving our Shan girls. One day she came up to me, about a year and a half ago, and said, "Hey, can I take the girls on an outreach to a Shan village in the mountains?" And I said, "In the mountains? Well, like where?" Well, she said, "I'll show you." So sometime later, we got in our car, her and her friend, and off we went for about 2 hours winding through the mountains. I'm thinking, where are we going? And we came to a place that I'll call the Mountain Village. It was here that we met her former pastor, who we will simply call P.S. today. Now, P.S. had been a heroin addict for many years. He could have died countless times, but he found Christ in a rehab center. And now he has a passion to reach his own people. He's 66 years old, but he pedals his bicycle up and down the hills several times a week to go to this mountain village. But he said to me, "My grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness." When our dorm mom introduced me to P.S., he had already been cycling to this mountain village from the town he lives in for 15 years. The people of the mountain village have been forced off their land and fled to this mountain. Remember, they're lowland rice farmers, but now they're living on this ledge, on this ridge. And P.S. is passionate to help them and share with them the transforming power of Jesus. Well, 3 years ago, something heartbreaking happened. One day, P.S. was there in the mountain village, and he found out that four of the young men were addicted to meth. And since the pastor himself had been a heroin addict much of his life, he began to help them to break their habit. Well, soon the word spread throughout the hills that there was a Sean man, a Christian of all things, who was helping these four young men. Within a few weeks, 55 others had come. Well, there was no place for them to live in the mountain village, which was incredibly poor itself. It's really an internally displaced camp, according to the UN. So he went down the road into the jungle where there was a stream, and they began to build huts out of bamboo for these drug addicts to live in. Well, by the time PS showed me the camp in June of 2018, there was no longer 55 men there. The numbers had swollen to 700. And today there are over 1,000 men and women in the camp, all drug addicts who've come searching for help. They come from all across the Shan states. Word is spread that there is a Shan pastor who will help them, and so in desperation they come. Now, when I first met P.S., this was actually the first meeting, he said, "Can you help me?" He says, "Can you help me provide a safe place for these broken people to live here in the jungle? Can you help me disciple them so they might turn from the darkness of the spirit world to the light of the Lord Jesus Christ?" A few weeks later, I was standing in front of several hundred of these men sharing the stories of Jesus, and then it hit me. For years, we'd been praying, "Lord, where are the men?" Even just a handful. Little did I know that God was preparing something far beyond what I could have imagined. And here I was standing in front of several hundred men desperate for help. Well, earlier I told you that it was our dorm mom in the pink here who first told me about the mountain village. She wanted permission to take the Shan scholars under her care from the valley village to share the compassion of Christ with the mountain village. And that's why she took me and showed it to me. But little did she know that the mountain village had now become, just down the road along the stream, the home of over 1,000 drug addicts that had come looking for help. And so, yes, I did give permission to her and our teen girls to go and serve. But they would not go alone. We would go with them, Lynn and I, our Filipino colleagues, and our dorm mums, and 16 of our Shan scholars. P.S. had been asking us to come and put on a Christmas festival for the men and women in the mountain village. Since 95 to 99% of them are Buddhists, they have no idea what Christmas is all about. So on December 7, a month ago, we were all up before dawn on what turned out to be one of the coldest nights in winter. Sorry, it's not like your winters. But when there's no heating of any sort, it was cold. Several of our girls vomited in the winding roads up into the mountains, and almost all of them were sick by that night on the way home, traveling back from the mountain village. But he said to me, "My grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness." The girls were bundled up in their winter coats and blankets. This is when we got to the ridge. But now the sun had come out, it was a little better. But they were shivering and cold, yet what they experienced that day soon eclipsed any of their personal sufferings or discomfort. The remote camp that we were traveling to has no electricity, no plumbing, no running water, and often not enough food to eat. But these drug addicts had come here because there was nowhere else to go. And we together put on a Christmas party like they had never seen before. From beginning to end, the only name exalted that day was the name of the Lord Jesus Christ. It was not the Lord Buddha. And it was not the legion of other spirit gods that they know. It was only the Lord Jesus Christ. They heard the good news of Christ through preaching, through music, through dance, and through drama. They saw how our team of Canadians and Filipinos, but mostly Sean, have been radically changed by the gospel. This picture captures what the day was all about for me. Moments after these men received their simple Christmas gift in a Ziploc bag. By the way, the gift was soap, toothbrush, toothpaste, and a little hand towel. A pen and a small notebook. That was gigantic for them. But there was something else in the Ziploc, and you see the man here pulling it out, and it's a gospel tract in his native language about what Christmas is all about. In the evening, I was about to tell the story of Christmas from the Bible, dressed in my Sean outfit. It's kind of partially shown here today. And my Filipino colleague, Jenny, would translate from English to Thai. Most of the Sean understand Thai as well, so that worked. Hundreds of men and women were gathered around, sitting on the ground, some huddled around open fires to keep warm. Moments before I was called to the stage, Jenny almost collapsed in the washroom from a sudden attack of nausea. Darwin, her husband, rushed to get her. She could hardly breathe. But he said to me, "My grace is sufficient for you. My power is made perfect in weakness." Somehow they got her up. They brought her down below the stage where I was. She sat there and someone gave her a mic, and she powerfully translated the message that I gave to hundreds of men and women who were there. As our teen girls mounted the stage that night, I thought to myself, who are these girls anyhow? They're just ordinary girls from a poor Sean village, many who 4 years ago were destined to become prostitutes. But the grace of God reached down to save them through the loving discipleship of our Filipino teammates. And now here they are, radiating the love of Christ to hundreds of broken men and women recovering from drug addiction. The following afternoon, we sat down with our Sean scholars and asked them how the trip had impacted them. Through tears, they poured out their hearts as they reflected on all that had happened. Without exception, all of them found great joy in serving their own people in the mountain camp. One of our girls in the green t-shirt here, her name is In. She had got up early that Saturday morning, and in the cold darkness, slipped on the only two jackets that she owns. She reasoned that she really didn't need both of them and silently asked the Lord to show her who she should give her second jacket to. None of us knew this. The Lord had prompted her. So we went up to the mountain village, spent the day there. Late that evening, after our program was over, shortly before we left, she quietly walked over to one of the women sitting there on the ground, took off the jacket and slipped it over her, and with a blessing, walked away. So what does all this mean for you and I? How do we respond? I'm going to leave you with three words. You've heard them before. The first word is to pray. Pray for the unreached peoples. Jesus urges us to pray. Choose one or two unreached people groups. Learn everything you can about them and intercede for them. Adopt them. Pray for them. There are two things that can aid your prayers for the Sean. One is to sign up for our email updates if you don't get them, and many other booths here where you can follow what God is doing among the unreached around the world. The other thing is to pick up a scarf like the one I'm wearing here. These are made by Sean women in our Valley Village. And you can take a scarf home. It's $10 or $5 or a toonie or whatever you have. And use it as a prayer scarf that every time you wear it, you can remember to pray for the Sean. The second word is to give. Oh, that's the first. That's the scarce. Many projects, but I just want to mention today, one of our Filipino workers really needs a used car for her ministry among the unreached Isan people, another people group of 18 million in Thailand. Her name is Arnie, and I can give you more information. There's also a sheet on the table if you would be interested in supporting a Filipino worker so she has wheels to reach the Isan people. And then the third one is to go. Go find the unreached, for they are everywhere. Go find them. Go love them. Go serve them. And by all means, go share the power of the gospel, even through your weakness. They are in the city. They live throughout your province. They live across our country. But many of them are still in their homelands, in far-flung places around the world, where they have no access to the gospel. Wherever you go, across this city or across the world, it will not be easy. But by now you know that God is not looking for superheroes. God still needs ordinary people like you and I. And if you're waiting for God to first remove the thorns, guess what? It might not happen. But you would realize by now that more often than not, the thorns are here to stay. He may never remove the thorns that continue to torment you. But one thing he does, he leaves you with a promise that always rings true. He says to you, "My grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in your weakness." God bless.